If you work in product marketing, you know that building a story that lands in one market is hard enough. Getting it to work everywhere simultaneously is where most global marketing launches fall apart. But there's a better way to think about how products go to market globally. My guest today is Erin Rouche, Global Product Marketing Manager at Sage. You can listen to this on all major podcast platforms and watch it on YouTube. Erin, welcome. Thank you for being here. You describe yourself as a builder PMM, and so that means someone who turns complex and new capabilities into clear positioning. How does that challenge change depending on the country and when the product has to be different depending on the country you're proposing it into?
That's such a good question. So currently I'm at an enterprise SaaS company and we operate across, over 20 different markets. And so it's really interesting in technology because often the needs of a business don't really change that drastically, right? So if you're taking a small business, for instance, you know, they want better cash flow visibility. They want lower costs, higher revenue, better stickiness for their customers. So the needs don't change, but in each country, the trigger could change, right? Yeah. For why they need that thing. Yeah. The legislation is different, the environment and the culture and the pressures that they're feeling. And therefore, for me, since I sit in marketing, the story that I tell has to change, right? Because it's so deeply contextual. And I often think about my own self. So I'm an American. I'm married to a South African. I live in the UK. So I'm very much familiar with being a global citizen. And I remember when I moved to the UK, I actually work at my current company. I like to say I'm the product of good marketing because they showed up in a job advert on a forum where I was looking and they said the words, you know, fancy working in tech while doing a school run. And it's interesting because as an American, the word school run doesn't even exist in the US. Like right. it was so highly contextual. And I read this and I was like, that is what I want, that you're speaking my language, you get where I am and the age of my kids and the trigger that I'm feeling and the pressure that I'm feeling. And so I think that the story that you tell just matters so much. And when I think about, if you kind of take that out to the macro world of business, you know, because I work in accounting and financial tech, our legislative environment is, it's not that sexy to talk about, but something called like making tax digital. And it affects really, really small businesses. So when we tell the story to a small business of why they might need tech, it might be two builders having a chat on a tea break, right? Mm-hmm. Who are like, oh my gosh, MTD is so stressful. But if I was to lift and shift that story into the French or the Italian market, it's not going to translate. They might be sipping cappuccino, talking about e-invoicing. And so you have to realize that while the need is the same, the trigger is different. Therefore, the story has to be different.
Yeah. And that's such an important point as well. You mentioned moving countries.
Mm.
The more you move or you go out of your culture, the more you learn about it, really. You realize, okay, this is the culture I'm in, but you haven't realized until you go out of it, you know? So that's a very good thing to have as an experience for your position.
Exactly.
Most product launches still follow a source language first, then adapt everything model. Is that actually a problem? And where does it show further down the line?
It can be a problem. And it's interesting because I think it depends on the stakes of the communication. So like if you take often in enterprise SaaS, we have intranet pages where even inside of our businesses, we need to communicate with all of our colleagues all around the world. And we'll often use something like AI to just kind of take an intranet page, click the button, I've had to do this in my own work, and suddenly it's in French, it's in Spanish, it's in whatever. Mm. But I know that I'm rolling the dice a little bit when I do that. But I don't always have the phone a friend in the other country, right? Who could say, you know, I could pick up the phone, hey, can you review this for me?
Yeah.
But it's an internal communication. So there is a trade-off I'm getting for maybe accuracy, for speed, and for resourcing.
Yeah.
But there are other things like a .com that you just can't get wrong. And so I've been in companies where that's a very rigorous and a very slow process because the stakes are high when you get it wrong. And I always think back to this story of Pepsi in the 1990s. Have you heard this one?
I've heard of it, but let you explain it for
It's where the logo at the time, or the tagline was, you know, Pepsi brings you back to life. And somehow that translated to, in the Asia market, to Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the grave. It did not land. Mm. And so that was an example of where, now 1990s pre-AI, but imagine now when content is even more rapidly firing out, if it is high stakes, you have to have, that level of rigor and review.
Viral. Completely viral nowadays. Well,
exactly.
It kind of did. Where does AI then genuinely help you? Help in your go-to-market execution? And have you also seen some places where it quietly undermines it, like your work?
I live and breathe AI. I think that the market is changing, particularly for product marketing. We're kind of exiting the era of, you know, I write the messaging framework. I painstakingly craft every single value proposition. AI is going to do that. It's going to do it at pace. But there is this speed for accuracy trade-off that you're constantly doing in your brain. And so where it's helping, just a couple weeks ago, I was writing sort of a paper for an analyst audience or an external audience. And it took me about a half a day, but it was a really, really high stakes piece of communication. So even with AI, I admit, I was kind of like, sometimes when I'm driving AI, I almost feel like I'm like pedal to the metal. Like, let's see what this baby can really do. And while I was doing that, by 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, I was like, this is amazing. Like, my boss is going to love this. Until Monday rolled around and I reread what seemed so great at 5 o'clock on a Friday. And I was like, I loved my boss. She said, it's a very nice word salad, Erin. And it was so true. With a clear mind, I was like, what is this? And I had to rewrite the document with a much firmer human review and process. It saved me time because the structure was great.
Okay.
But it had over-indexed on internal documents and the conversation had changed, but my inputs hadn't reflected that. And so, I'm constantly doing the math in my head of where it helps and where it hurts.
How interesting to know that you hadn't seen that on the Friday, you know, that you were so into it.
It's like a drug, like the AI. You kind of, you're working at such a pace and you're so enamored with the speed of it and the breadth of it that sometimes you can get a bit like AI drunk, and then you almost have to kind of pull back and say, wait a minute, like, would I really write this with my own mind and what I know about the market and the tone of which I need to communicate with this audience?
And that's why a review is also so important, like someone else potentially reviewing it, you know? Mm-hmm. So our latest research at RWS on the state of content in 2026 shows that only 6% of global leaders trust AI for cultural nuance. As a product marketer, how do you build a global launch taking that gap into consideration?
So I think as we're scaling with AI, product marketers are going to become sort of the orchestrators of agents, of army of agents. And as we're speeding up that process, the quality of our inputs are going to be as important as the outputs that we need. Mm. And so we used to talk, I feel like 2025 was the year of prompt engineering. Everybody was talking about that. And now it's context engineering is the new buzzword, but it's true and it's real. And so the way that you structure the input, both so you don't burn through your tokens, if you're a cloddy, as we're kind of starting to call them, if that's your LLM of choice, you can really rack up bills quite quickly. And so you need to think about, how are you pointing the AI to precisely what it needs to get the output you're looking for? And so I think that in that future, I can see cultural intelligence as becoming almost an MD file, right? Like, if you need to tell the LLM something that it might not know about the culture in which you're deploying,
right?
Especially when these models are trained so heavily on Western text,
Absolutely.
Western thought. And so I can see that being part of that context engineering framework is the cultural element that might be missing, because it's almost like a silent, as a product marketer, cultural nuance isn't the first thing I'm worried about. It's, are they the right value pillars? Are we going to hit the launch date?
Yeah.
And so, but it needs to be baked into the LLM and the work that you're doing at the ground.
What did you say the word was? Like you mentioned a couple of years ago, it was prompt engineering. What did you say?
Now it's context engineering.
Context engineering.
And I think cultural intelligence is part of that context,
right,
that the AI will need to get the output you need. You're going to have to engineer the context you're putting in better.
Okay. Very cool. Thank you. What does it look like when cultural intelligence then becomes like a strategic requirement as opposed to a localization fix at the end of the process? Oh, actually, we forgot localization, you know?
So I think you need to really begin with the end in mind here. I think back to a story of, I used to work in a corporate foundation and communications roles there. And it's an example of, if you haven't accounted for the word choice, even the meaning behind the word, at a strategy level, when you get to tactical execution, it just won't work. And so an example was, have you ever been told to like sponsor somebody climbing a mountain in like fundraising? You know, sponsor me for a marathon,
right,
or something like that.
Sports,
event. Exactly.
Yeah.
So in Germany, in our German market, it didn't land. The idea of what they might call sort of performative fundraising, the idea,
okay,
that like you would sponsor me to do an athletic event, kind of just doesn't resonate. And so we had to shift at the strategy level that if we're going to launch a certain campaign to achieve a certain outcome, we need to be much more mindful about how they would even interpret the word like sponsor, or even sort of these athletic kind of fundraisers that we were trying to launch. And then if you also think about, you know, in this age of AI, product marketers are going to have to look after more regions than ever before, because what we're seeing kind of in the workforce is a contraction. There will probably be potentially fewer junior roles because AI may start to automate some of that, but we'll also see potentially fewer people managers, and we're going to see a burgeoning in the middle,
yeah,
of senior individual contributors that have to do more launches across more regions for more products. So if you take a product marketer who is, let's say they're looking after all of EMEA, that would include Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and sometimes they also pack the A with Asia and Australia. Imagine the cultural nuance that if at the strategy level you weren't thinking, you know, will this campaign land across these markets, or how will we need to, and do we have the tools that we need to ensure that all of the layers of not just linguistic translation, but meaning translation are accounted for.
Mm-hmm. And we had a very similar question on another episode, but basically also a country is sometimes not the final destination. You need to go a little bit deeper as well. You know, it's not just one country equals one
exactly
version.
I mean, Europe, so the EU is,
yeah,
is so diverse. So
yeah,
you really need boots,
yeah,
on the ground to help you.
Can you share, I don't know if this is something you can share, but the example of how you localize it for Germany, that sport even?
Thankfully, I had a colleague in Germany who was kind, okay, of feeding this back to the mothership of in the UK and saying, like, if you launch that here, it will not work. And I'm so grateful for that colleague, because we were able to kind of rewire how, mm-hmm, we were going to roll out this campaign globally.
Okay, thank you. What is one thing that product marketing teams are still getting wrong about global launches, and especially in this day and age with AI, one thing, the main thing they're doing wrong?
I think they are focusing on speed and not enough on story. Because the story, it's, you need as a marketer for somebody to read your copy, right? And think, wow, they get me.
Mm.
And the worst thing in the world is for them to say, wow, you were really tone deaf, mm, and you missed the mark. I think about in the UK, so as an American who moved here, you know, the Christmas adverts that we always see.
Yeah.
And at first, they didn't really resonate with me because, well, I love Christmas. Christmas means something really different to me. Coming from Florida, like, it's not as cold. There's perks of being in the UK in the way that we celebrate here. But, like, the paper crowns.
Yeah.
We definitely don't wear paper crowns. We don't eat Brussels sprouts. So all of these adverts, they weren't evoking the same story for me of nostalgia, but they were for the audience where they were being targeted.
Mm.
And so I think that, yeah, we just have to constantly think about, is a story drawing somebody in, or without us realizing it, actually pushing them away?
Yeah.
Because that can make or break a brand and,
yeah,
copy.
because people sometimes go for more content. Well, brands, not people, they go for more content, thinking, you know, oh, it's going to reach someone, but it can reach someone and have the contrary effect. That's something good to keep in mind.
Exactly.
One last question, actually. What does cultural intelligence mean to you in a few words?
I think of cultural intelligence as that layer that needs to be on top of or used hand in hand with AI in the new era that we're in to make sure that the words that we say are actually grounded in the tone and the meaning and the context and the stories where we plan to use those words. And without it, I don't think communication will land or resonate the way it needs to.